Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Retall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
The comics we're going to be talking about this episode originally came out on July 8th, 2009. And this is the Weekly Comic Spotlight, episode 100. Seems like only 2 years ago we were starting this, Bob.
Yes, indeed it did. And it was almost. We first talked about this at the San Diego convention 2 years ago, I think. And then our first episode happened after you got home from the convention, right?
A couple of weeks after I got home, I had a few things with work or whatever, and we started it around that August or whatever.
Yep.
So a little shy of a month from 2 years.
Which will be episode 104, strangely, the number of weeks in 2 years.
We could do a second anniversary episode then.
Indeed. In addition to our Just Like Comics special 100th centenary episode, which we're doing even as we speak.
Yes.
So, do you want to get into it? We've got several special, we've got our normal comics this week, and then after we talk about our normal three comics, one Marvel, one DC, and one other, like we do every week for 100 weeks, we will do some special look back at issue 100s of comics from the past, and that'll be our special anniversary feature. So stick around after our normal three reviews, and we'll have that.
And
with that,
as a result, this episode may go a little long because we're talking about quite a few things. And I thought just to start us off with this, Bob, I mean, we usually start with our DC book, but I think we should start with our DC book and a ton of controversy.
Okay.
Because this DC book is Wednesday Comics number one.
And the book that is touted by many people on the internet as having been touched by the hand of God himself and the most perfect expression of comics ever to grace mortal eyes.
Wow. Well, I apparently haven't read that on the internet, and I'm glad.
I've been on some forums, and people are acting like they want to, you know, wallpaper their house with this thing and have its children and the whole business like this. So, yeah, I don't know.
But here we got 15 different stories, such as they are. We've got the format itself. Let's start with the format. This is on kind of a newsprint-ish kind of a quality, and that really hit me the minute I saw the cover. Because it's got kind of almost a gray tint to it, and particularly on that outer cover, the colors suck. They're muted, they feel washed out, and that made me go into this with a kind of a lackluster feeling in many respects.
Well, I first saw it at the comic shop. I went to the comic shop last week to pick up the other two books that we're reviewing. We'll get to after this. I had not pre-ordered, so I had to go and pick them up. And so I went to the comic shop. They had Wednesday Comics at the comic shop, and that was the very first thing that struck me when I saw it on the rack was – it, and this is no comment on the quality of the art, quality of the stories, but it looked cheap to me. Additional to that, since it folds out, it does a double kind of fold out, and it doesn't fold back together quite the way that it folded up, you know, in the first place after you've read it. Everyone in the comic shop wants to see this thing. So people are like opening these things up and kind of partially folding them and sticking back. I think this is going to be a problem to comic shop owners because, you know, I went to like three different comic shops on Saturday looking for the one book we're reviewing called Drafted 100 Days. It wasn't at, you know, it's an indie book, so I had to look a little bit. But every shop had Wednesday Comics, and every shop had more than one copy that had been browsed and kind of ill-fittedly kind of put back together and stuffed back on the rack, because certainly if I'm going to open one up and browse it in the store, I'm then going to buy an unsullied copy to take home with me. Yeah, so I'm not sure what's going to happen to these shop owners that have got, you know, like two, three, four. One of the shops I was in had four or five that had been browsed through. And this is a $3.99 thing, you know, that has been kind of thrashed up. That's a bit of an overhead for a comic shop to be coming in. What I think might be a good idea for shops to do is have one copy that is the designated browsing copy and doing something to kind of pull the other ones aside and bag them or something so they can at least sell them in a pristine shape. Because I'll tell you what, as many people as I've talked to and heard talk about this who are all on this, well, you know, it's this fabulous thing and you should just fold it up and stuff it in your back pocket and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, yeah, but would you pay $3.99 at the comic shop for one that's already been browsed through, or are you going to be buying the pristine one and leaving that browsed one for some other poor sucker to buy? You know, I'm not sure. And additionally, you know, when I got comics for a quarter, I was a lot, you know, pay a quarter for a comic, make $2 for washing my dad's car. Okay, I can fold it in half and stick it in my pocket, you know. This one, it's $4. If I'm a kid or whoever, I don't make $32 for washing a car, so I'm not sure I feel like folding it in half and stuffing it in my pocket. I don't know. The format does not impress me. I mean, I like the large reproduced art. It's nice. Some of the contents, as we talk about the story, I was about 50-50. I think, you know, several of the stories were brilliant, in my opinion. I loved them. But several other ones I thought were weak at best.
Part of it for me is I was unimpressed with the format to begin with. The lack of a crisp white paper didn't help this. Flipping it open to a double page ad and then flipping it open again to actually get to the real contents kind of...
I thought that putting that robot chicken on there was extremely poor judgment on DC's part.
Yes, yes. That should have been a two-page DC Nation thing of, hey, welcome to Wednesday Comics.
Something like that. Just flipping it open to this ad, very poor form, in my opinion.
But, I mean, there were a couple of people on our previous teleconference the other night saying, you know, but you're getting four times the page count. Sure, it's 15 pages of comics, because that 16th page is the two-page ad in the front and back cover, essentially. So 15 pages of content, but they're saying, no, it's really like four times that. And I'm going to say, no, it's not.
Yeah.
While they're four times the size of the average comic page, I don't know that we got four times the content. In one case, I think we did. Most, I'm going to say, maybe twice the normal amount of content for a standard page.
I'm saying on average, I would say it's maybe 1.5 times the content that I would see on a normal page of comics. It really is not even, doesn't feel like it's even double.
There were a couple where I would say maybe double, but there was like the Sergeant Rock one. That was one page of content, standards.
Yeah.
It's just bigger.
Even the Batman one, which is the first one. I mean, there's no way that's two pages of content.
Page and a half, maybe two pages.
Page and a half, maybe. And the same thing with Superman, you know?
No, I agree with that. And, you know, just going...
Got like 9 or 10 panels, you know? It's like, okay.
I mean, just going kind of... I can't say story by story because, I mean, you get a page... In a lot of these cases, I felt the story didn't even start. That rubbed me the wrong way.
Well, it's supposed to be like a serial. And you know what? I mean, looking at it on that respect, okay? Because I have read, for instance, a lot of Hal Foster, Prince Valiant stuff.
Right.
Right? And those were like single page, Sunday, you know, color things. And this is... That's, I think, what they were trying to be evocative of with this.
Oh, certainly, certainly.
A couple of these were very successful with this. Commandy, as an example. Brilliant job on Commandy. Commandy actually felt a lot like an old Prince Valiant page to me.
Well, let's just go kind of quickly in order so we're sure to hit them.
So, Batman.
For me, it was an intro to a story, and I just couldn't get around why did Gordon wait until so late in the game to call back. I mean, it was a weak start of a story at best, and it's a teaser of a story.
Batman, it was okay, didn't impress me particularly. The art nor the story impressed. Commandy. I thought Commandy was pretty good. I thought Commandy was bordering on brilliant. I liked how they're bringing you into the world of Commandy. It was, like I said, very evocative of a Hal Foster, Prince Valiant page. design sense nice. I thought that was really nicely done.
I'll give you the evocative of kind of the newspaper full page, you know, Prince Valiant kind of a thing. I think this one did hit that right on the head with that. No argument there. This was a good kind of a recap of the premise and a quasi-cliffhanger-ish ending kind of a thing. Again, going back to that newspaper full-page style of storytelling. Good start of a story. I would say definitely one of the stronger of the bunch. No question about that. I was not wowed by it, but I liked it.
And I'm not going to go by story content on any of these because, I mean, it's like one page.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's
so
unfair.
It's like you're not going to get a story out of any of these. I did like the fact that you got something going on here, and it kind of left you on a cliffhanger, an effective cliffhanger, let's say. Because I would say that I think they were trying to leave you with a cliffhanger on the Superman story on the next page and sort of failed.
Well, with the Commandy one, I thought it was a solid start to the story. It set the scene well and got things. Most of the stories I don't think did that. The Superman one on this next page would not have convinced me to go track down this title. I thought it was weak. And again, maybe a page in a standard comic.
Yeah, I agree with you. Weak is the best I could say about Superman.
Yeah. Now moving on to the Dead Man. This had one of the more interesting page layouts, I think. The art style wasn't really to my liking. This one, to me, felt like the cliff notes of like the first issue of, say, a miniseries or a story arc. And I don't mean that in a good or a bad way, just kind of that's how it read to me. It quickly sets the scene, it gets things moving, we end on, oh, it's the killer. Kind of, you know, and that's how I would imagine the first issue of a miniseries would have gone.
Yeah. Most effective story. I won't say most, but it was a very effective story. Didn't care for the art. The art was not to my personal liking, which detracted from it quite a lot. Green Lantern, I liked it. I liked the design sense. Again, it was mostly set up. I like where it's going. Once I finally get like the full 10 or 12 page story, you might have something there. Good start, but in and of itself, not a whole lot going on.
Well, to me, this is one that's written for those in the know. Because if you're not familiar with Green Lantern, you're not going to know Hal is Green Lantern. And this was all kind of prologue to the story for me. There was nothing in here to really hook me on this. It's nice art. I like Kurt Busiek as a writer. I'm sure when the whole thing's said and done, it'll be really good. But as a page, hard sell. And it's a hard sell for anything in this with that, because you only get a page.
Metamorpho. I loved the Metamorpho page. Mike Allred did a great job on this. Nice story. Does a beautiful sapphire stag. I like the design of the page. I like the little heads down along the bottom. Gave a little less story content because you got this big logo at the top, the little thing on the bottom. But that said, I'm thinking this is going – I'd be curious to see issue two because are they going to have this big header and footer on every single one, or is it just because this is the very first page of the story
that we get? That's a good point. If it's everything, that sucks. If it's just this, I'm okay with it. I like this one. Again, Mike Allred, hard to go wrong with that. The story was good, but again, it was another one that felt almost like the preamble to a story versus, okay.
But interestingly, he seemed to get a lot of stuff in this small number of panels.
Yes, there was a hell of a lot in this preamble, no question about that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I felt like I got a lot more. I mean, I felt like I got like three times as much story as I got out of the Superman page, for instance.
Well, because we get some of, you know, the relationships between the characters, between Simon Stagg, Java, Sapphire, Rex, all that kind of a stuff. I mean, a lot happens there, and it probably made some of the best use of the space. So I would say this, again, was one of the highlights of the thing.
But fascinating that, I mean, 11 panels, you know, by my count here, and you got this amazing amount of content in just 11 panels. So very nicely done.
Yeah, well, and part of it's not just the panels, but how you use them. And again, this is a good case of well use of the space. Now, counterpoint to that is this next page with the Teen Titans.
I am a
huge Teen Titans fan. I thought this sucked.
Oh, you know, draw Wonder Girl without even eyes and a nose. I mean, come on. Do we have some art editors like saying, maybe you might want to think about throwing some facial features on there, Sean? I just maybe it's a stylistic thing. I thought this was a waste of a page.
Certainly the top half where we get, you know, random characters out of random lineups of the Titans. None of the Titans are ever named in this thing. The only character we really get to know is the villain here of Trident. The last page was a little, or last panel, I mean, was a little unclear. I didn't like the art. Again, I think the top half of this page was wasted. It was a horrible start to a story, and to me, this was one of the low points of the issue.
Yep. He appears to be stabbing Ms. Martian there, but anyone doesn't know these characters is like not going to know what the hell's going on.
Yeah.
That.
Now, with Strange Adventures, I didn't really care for the art style or the lettering, but the story definitely got started. It had its sense of style about it, and I think this was one of the more successful, again, going back to the Prince Valiant kind of full-page comic story thing. I mean, they got the story started. Things happened here. We got to know some of the characters. So, while I didn't like the style and the aesthetic about it, I think this was successful.
Yeah, I like Paul Pope's art style, so this is Paul Pope. I wasn't too keen on the blue stripe across Alana's face. I don't recall ever seeing that as a established thing, and that wasn't working for me. Other than that, I liked it. Liked it a lot. Supergirl, you know, nice art. You know, Amanda Connor drawing Supergirl and some super pets flying around. Not a lot happened, but, you know, it was nice to look at.
I really like this one. I mean, Amanda Connor art, hard to go wrong with that. It's a cute premise for a story, but literally a fly-by appearance by Supergirl. And this is something that I'm sure I'm going to really enjoy this when it's all said and done and I read the whole thing. But as far as one-page installments, I don't know that it's going to be enough to satisfy me in terms of story. But again, that's a hard sell for all of these. Now, ironically, I think the next one with Metal Men succeeded in that. To me, this was the best of the bunch. Well, it might be a little confusing to people not familiar with the Metal Men. I really like this. I thought they told a lot of story here. I thought they told a lot of good story. And I haven't read this enjoyable of a Metal Men story in ages.
It was an excellent Metal Men story, since they're all looking like humans, pretty much. And they do the little key character thing at the top of them in their robot form.
Mm-hmm.
Again, and I can pick out which one is which, because I know the Metal Men. But, you know, someone who's not familiar with the Metal Men are going to be kind of lost on this. I liked it, though. I think DiDio did a really nice job on this. I do think it'll, you know, read more effectively when it's more of a complete story. This is my probably second favorite after Commandy. I really like that. Actually, no, well, I mean, I like Commandy. I liked Metamorpho. I like this Metal Men. Those are my top three so far. I loved all of those.
For me, this was a step above the others, but I certainly can see where you like those and don't fault you for that. Now, Wonder Woman here, I think, had the most content in it. This would be the equivalent of a couple of pages of story, maybe five or six even.
The most content, yet at the same time, the most incomprehensible content.
I was going to say, yeah, it's the furthest afield. It's a very non-standard approach to Wonder Woman. I didn't like the art, didn't care for the story, but I'll give it some credit. We got the most number of panels and most story from it. I just didn't care for what they did.
I couldn't even force myself to read that bottom row of panels.
Yeah.
I just, my mind, like, I could, this guy could not even hold my attention for
a page.
A page. It's like way too much text, way too much stuff going on. I don't mind the art style. It's kind of like that loose, kind of rough pencil sketch kind of style. I didn't like these. I mean, I liked the Diana stuff. Wasn't too keen on, what are these supposed to be, like the Fates or something like that? That's what they look like, the three kind of purpley, ghostly
ladies. I think so, yeah.
It looks like, you know, Clotho, Lachesis, and whatever, Atropos, the three Greek fates are supposed to be usually in those forms. But it's just like, I don't care. You know, it's like, next.
To me, it didn't seem like a Wonder Woman story.
So, Sergeant Rock.
I liked this. I thought it was an effective page, but it was an effective standard size comic page.
Yeah.
You know, this is a 9-panel grid layout. I'm sure it's going to be an absolutely brilliant story when it's all said and done. I think it'll tell reasonably well in single page increments, but I'm certainly not seeing, you know, this mythical 4 pages of content some people were saying we were going to get.
I don't want to prejudge an entire story on one page, but given that the whole story is going to be at most 12 pages long, spending a whole page on Rock tied up, getting beaten on, not convinced that's the best choice. Maybe a little more action-oriented might have been the way to go. And by action, I mean Rock doing something other than getting the living crap kicked out of him.
Yeah, it depends where they're going on this. I mean,
they could turn it around, but inauspicious beginning.
Fair enough.
The Flash one I thought was a very interesting choice with devoting half of the landscape to this Iris West kind of heart of Juliet Jones kind of story.
I thought that was really interesting too, and what did not work for me on the Iris West part was the coloring effect.
The pixelated, I think they're doing that on purpose, but...
I'm sure they're doing it on purpose, but it sucked.
Yeah.
It was really bad, it was distracting. And, you know, I felt this is one where we got maybe 4 pages of content. Two double-page splashes.
I would have rather seen the whole thing be the Flash, though.
Yeah, same here. But, I mean, to me, this goes back to what I would consider the classic era of the Flash. You know, Barry Allen around the late, you know... 200s of his run, you know, around 275 to somewhere in there. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I enjoyed this. This is what I would consider kind of the closest to standard comic book fare for most of these heroes. Although the Sergeant Rock, I think, is exactly what would have been done in a standard comic, too. Now, what did you think of this Demon Cat?
You know, set up again. Knowing who Jason Blood is, knowing who Selina Kyle is, knowing a lot of backstory on both the characters, you can kind of pick up and get into this. And, you know, this is something we were talking about. This may be a good point to talk about this. Who is the audience of this thing?
I have no idea at this point.
It is said that this is maybe a love letter to hardcore comics geeks. So if that's the case, content-wise, okay, I can see why they went the direction that they went. Because, I mean, some of these, you know, more inscrutable pages like this Demon and Catwoman one and the Metal Men one to some extent are, you know the characters, you're right into it, and, you know, you don't feel like you walked in the middle of a movie because you kind of know who the players are and you know the backstory and stuff. Someone who's never read this stuff before and picks it up, they're not going to know what the hell is going on reading this page.
Yeah.
But that being said, I mean, I think there's a certain style of hardcore comic fan that this is going to appeal to, and I'm maybe not that kind because the format of this just annoys me.
Well, it's like going for hardcore comic book fans that were also hardcore newspaper comic strip full page fans. And I think that that's a really small group.
You know, I don't know, because I don't think it's just that, because a lot of the people that, you know, even ones that were on the call last Friday, I don't think they're people who were even around when they were doing full-page Sunday strips. I don't know that they are in love with that format particularly as much as they're in love with the idea of it. And, you know, they just, like, kind of got themselves really juiced up about how much this is cool and how much they're going to love it. I mean, I kind of like went into it as, okay, I'll wait and see. I was predisposed to not like the format, and that was maybe a self-fulfilling prophecy. It was a giant pain in the butt to read this.
Well, I think it says something about the printing quality, though, when I think the stuff looks better in previews than it does in the comic. I mean, I think we get better printing quality there, or at least the same if certainly no worse. Now, rounding out this issue was the final feature of Hawkman. This one totally didn't work for me at all.
Yeah, it's like told from the standpoint of some bird, I guess.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, interesting. Nice drawing of Hawkman in the middle, but got 5 panels and a bird's narrating it.
Yeah. Again, it's one where I'm waiting for the story to start.
It's an interesting take. Something I've never seen before. I'll give them that. I didn't love it. It was okay.
For me, most of these stories didn't work. They didn't set the scene, they didn't get me hooked, etc. And I'm debating at this point, particularly since I'm not going to have time to read the next couple of weeks since I'll be at San Diego and stuff. you know, I'll have, you know, a quarter of the series almost, you know, waiting to be read. I may just hold off reading the remaining ones till I have them all, at which point I probably should have just waited for the collected edition.
I kind of had the same feeling, you know, but the thing is, it's like, you know, since we pre-order our stuff, I've already got the whole series pretty much pre-ordered, so, oh well.
Yeah, yeah, I'm in a similar boat. I mean, I physically don't like the format. I don't think they made as good a use of the bigger-sized pages as they could have. It felt like a lot of these were just essentially double-page spreads that were just blown up bigger.
Well, I mean, it just almost, you know, realistically, it just looked like it was mostly maybe a little bit larger in the original art size, but it just seemed like it was comic book art that they reproduced one-to-one instead of reducing it like they do when they do a regular comic.
Yeah. I certainly, with the exception of the Wonder Woman story, did not feel we were getting kind of four times the amount of content. And if you count this as 15 story pages, and to be fair, it's probably more the equivalent of, say, roughly 30. And that, I think, is being generous. But it's $3.99. At the 15 pages, I mean, that's 26.6 cents a page.
If you give them the 30 pages, then that's the standard 30 pages for $3.99 that you get in any DC book. So I can see that. To me, the format is a nuisance. Maybe not a popular point. You know, some people love it, you know.
I found it awkward to read.
Yeah. I ended up having to lay down and, you know, just kind of spread it out. I mean, you certainly, it's too thin to sit and hold and read because it's just like flopping all over on itself and you can't sit up and read the thing.
Yeah.
Which maybe they want to evoke, and, you know, you got some people, ooh, it's just like when you were a kid and you were laying on the floor reading the Sunday comics. And I was, yeah, okay.
That's fine. I'm not a kid anymore. I don't lay on the floor reading the Sunday comics. When I read my comics, I've usually got a lap desk thing that I put the comic, lay it flat on. That's why I don't like prestige books or square-bound ones. They don't lay flat. You know, I'm very stick in the mud that way, maybe, but this was an interesting experiment. I don't begrudge having pre-ordered all of it, but I would have liked a whiter white on the paper to where the colors popped out more. The fact they were so mute and subdued really kind of killed aspects of the story for me. It was awkward to read, and in one-page installments, it's a hard sell.
Yeah, all I can say is, like, based on this, if they do a Wednesday Comics 2, I won't be buying it.
Yeah.
I mean, I liked like half of the stuff that was in here, and I actively disliked about a third of it. I mean, it's like recap. I mean, the ones that I really liked, for me personally, I liked Commandy, Green Lantern, Metal Men, Supergirl, Metamorpho, and Adam Strange. That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I liked 6 of them. I actively disliked Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Teen Titans. So that's 4 that I actively disliked. And the other ones I was kind of like, meh, you know, on. Which is maybe about standard for any anthology.
For me, the ones that really worked were Metal Men, Flash, Supergirl, and I'm holding out for Green Lantern. Some of the others just didn't work for me. There were ones like Commandy. I thought it was good, but not one of those where I thought, you know, wow, I've just got to be getting it for that one. To me, the only one that it would almost justify getting it solely for the one feature was Metal Men.
Seeing that, I would love to see Dan DiDio, Kevin Nolan, see these guys do an actual Metal Men book.
Oh, yeah, exactly, and that's it. There were very few where I thought, this team needs to go do an ongoing or miniseries with that. And along those lines, I would say Metamorpho worked on that, certainly Command. And if you use that as the benchmark.
I think the Commandy actually works, is of all these, Commandy's the one to me that works best in this format. Because, I mean, again, to me, and the reason I liked it is because it was evocative of the Hal Foster, Prince Valiant pages. I think this particular Commandy style would not be as effective in a book.
That's
in a
fair.
Regular.
That's fair. I can see that.
But the other ones, you know, I wouldn't mind seeing most of those other ones that I liked as an ongoing series. You know, I would absolutely not want to see any more of the Titans or Wonder Woman or, probably even, you know, this Batman. And I mean, the Batman, while I didn't like it in this format, I mean, Azzarello and Rizzo have done other Batman stuff I've liked. So if they had a lengthier format, they'd probably turn out a fairly credible tale.
Well, and again, this is a really difficult undertaking for any creative team to tell an interesting, effective, and intriguing story in one-page installments. That's an uphill battle. But, I mean, they came up with this format, not me. So, you know, I'm going to hold them to that.
So, overall, I mean, I'd give it a 4.
Really?
It was above average. You know, it's on the, like with any anthology. I mean, I liked 6 of the stories a lot, you know. So, it's like a low 4, high 3 kind of thing. I mean, you know, the format really kind of pulls me back on it. You know, like talk myself into maybe even a 3 on it. I mean, you know, the format probably dings it back, so I'll go with the high 3 on it just because of the format that I dislike.
I went with a 2. I didn't like the format, I think, both in terms of the physical format and that stuff, but also, again, the one-page installments on 15 different stories. It's a hard sell. Few of these stories got me intrigued towards, like, I want to see what happens next. And for a lot of these, you know, if I were to never finish that Teen Titans story at this point, I really wouldn't care.
Yeah.
So it was an interesting experiment. I'm glad they did it. I'm going to ride it out. I got no problems with that. I don't begrudge that. I think it was a little overpriced. I think they could have done a better job on the format. And maybe if they'd done 2 pages per story and only told 8 stories or something, you know, they would have gotten a little more story momentum per story per installment. So, it's not hideous, it's not horrible, but it was ineffective for me, and for me it didn't work as well as I would have liked it to. Shall we move on?
Yeah, let's go next to our Marvel book. So, next we've got Ms. Marvel, number 41. Actually, a good issue for me to jump back in. I had stopped getting Ms. Marvel when Carol Danvers allegedly died, and they replaced her with Moonstone in her own title. So I didn't get a few issues. But then we wanted to talk about this one, so I went in and picked it up off the rack. And I'm glad I did, because this issue actually has some interesting things going on. You know, it has the Avengers in it. It's got some Dark Avengers stuff. It's got Deadpool, who I could have done without. But overall, decent art. Moved along, and it looks like it's going to be kind of key in, at least by my mind, getting the title back on track. So I'm glad I jumped back on with this issue.
I don't know about you, Bob, but frankly, I'm getting a little tired of most Marvel books featuring villains posing as heroes.
I am exactly tired of it, too, which is why I stopped getting this when it became Moonstone instead of Carol Danvers.
I mean, I'll give them credit. At least with this one, they're doing something a bit different than most of the other Dark Reign titles. You know, I was a little puzzled, though, why the Moonstone Ms. Marvel took over the real Ms. Marvel's investigation of AIM. And they set that up an issue or two back. I mean, that, frankly, to me, makes no sense. You know, but, you know, I went with it, whatever. I mean, overall, I thought this was a good story. I agree, Deadpool didn't really need to be in it. And man, he is just getting overused these days. It seems like he's in every other Marvel book. On the flip side, I thought the use of Spider-Man and Wolverine was really good. The rest of the new Avengers, though, I mean, they were placeholders. You know, if it hadn't have been for the caption saying that Ronan was in the book, I probably wouldn't have even noticed. I mean, he was practically invisible on that 2-page splash where he was first. You know, the form that Ms. Marvel is in this issue, I think would have made more sense for the female Captain Marvel, who's going by, I don't know, Photon or Pulsar or whatever name it is this week. But that 2-page fight scene, a couple of pages after the staple, where the new Avengers are fighting AIM, is it just me, or do the AIM guys look totally wrong in gray outfits?
I mean, yeah, they should be yellow.
It's yellow beekeeper, you know, suits or nothing. I mean, come on. They're ludicrous looking in yellow, I'll admit, but I mean, hey, it's a classic outfit.
Oh, it's what's established for him.
Yeah. Maybe this is the stealth angle.
Yes. No, but I mean, I thought it was a decent book. I mean, I'm glad I got it. I'm glad I got back into it with this issue. The stuff that I kind of didn't like about it seems like it's going to be reversed. So, you know, but again, I'm with you on the getting relatively tired of, you know, bad guys everywhere, you know.
Well, the other thing that we talked about one of the last times we reviewed this title was how the Ms. Marvel title just is routinely changing directions after, like, every other story arc or every story. And, I mean, this is no different. This is very different than the previous story arc, which was more of a Black Ops, kind of a spy sort of a thing, which was very...
I actually liked that. You know, that was an actually new, interesting direction for Ms. Marvel.
I mean, all of the different takes, by and large, have been fairly good, fairly interesting when she was leading the Lightning Force or whatever strike team. You know, I mean, they've done cool stuff, but it's almost, it doesn't matter if you like the current story arc or not, because they're going to change directions in a couple issues. And I find that a little frustrating, because, you know, not that I particularly love this arc, but, I mean, again, it doesn't matter if I do or not.
How's it been selling? I'm just wondering if, you know, like, they keep on changing things in hopes that it's going to somehow catch on and start climbing in sales or something. And when it has, you know, your standard issue over issue drop that most titles have, it's just, oh, well, that didn't work. It's still dropping. So let's change the status quo again and see if that makes a difference.
I don't think it's a matter of them flipping directions every six issues to find an approach that works, because, I mean, that's kind of naive if they're doing that. Because I'd be hard-pressed to name any title that's done that sort of a thing and suddenly just clicked with the audience and has worked. It was at rank 82 in May with issue 39. It did 24,756 estimated units. And that is not the lowest it's been, but one of the lowest it's been. It was lower with issue 33. But it was at 27,531 with issue 38. Back around issue 30, it was up above 40,000. That was probably during the Civil War, Secret Invasion, or one of those major storylines. Prior to issue 25, it was back down around that 25,000, 24 to 26,000 mark.
Well, it's down in that danger zone area, the Captain Marvel zone. Or not, yeah. Captain Britain.
Sorry. Yeah, I was going to say, Captain Marvel hadn't had a series in a while. That's pretty low.
I'm looking at this book that says Ms. Marvel and just came out. So, anyway. Captain Britain.
Captain Britain was actually down below 18,000. So we got about an 8,000 unit difference.
Yeah.
So I'd put this at the lower echelon of stable and viable sales. For Marvel title, I'm going to say once it gets below like 20,000, maybe even 22,000, that's when it starts to get into danger. So I don't think they're doing this as a, you know, let's do another take and see if that'll catch on, so much as they just have either different writers with different ideas or I don't know. Again, to me, this is them treating it like a series of trade paperbacks with each one having a unique story and take to it. You know, sure, it's got the same character across the trades, but it's not like they're expecting readers to go from the first trade paperback to the second to the third to the fourth with a sense of an ongoing narrative there, like I kind of expect to have happen from issue to issue to issue of a monthly title. I mean, I'm liking what they're doing. I think they've been doing some good stuff on this title. I think it's one of the better takes on, again, the Dark Reign stuff, but it's got such a, you know, this too shall pass aspect to it, just because, you know... They're very much setting up, I think, the next story arc, you know, in this. And again, I'm fine with that. I expect change in the titles, but I'd like to see this series get some kind of direction, trajectory, something to where if somebody likes it now, the odds of them liking it next year and it having a kind of a similarity from now to then, that there's at least a chance of that. So overall, I thought this was a good story. I gave it a rating of a 4. I was happy with it, though. So, I mean, that's that.
Yeah, I give it a 4 also. I mean, it was good enough to get me back into the title after I had dropped it. So next issue is for our 100th episode that we're doing here. We have drafted 100 days. So 100, kind of nice. Got your mandatory Barack Obama drawing on the cover. I'm going to be looking at this in a little different way than you because I have not read any of the previous drafted stuff before picking this up.
I've read all of it, I think. So, yeah, I think we're going to come at it from different angles.
Yeah. Now, that said, I mean, there was enough information in here for me to kind of pick up on what was going on. And I think I was able to follow along with the story just fine without having read the other drafted stuff. Because, I mean, realistically, this was kind of a standalone post-apocalyptic, you know, story. You know, you got Barack Obama leading this, you know, group, a ragtag group of people in a bad situation, and they're fighting against, you know, whatever odds and things like that. So, I mean, I'm not convinced that the what has gone before and drafted, other than what I was able to pick up, was that crucial to enjoying the story. But kind of be interested in what your take was on it, at least as far as how important you think the previous 12 issues were to getting into this.
I would say that they were certainly a good read and stuff, but frankly, if you've seen any Alien Invades Earth sci-fi movie, TV series, or anything of the sort, I mean, if you've heard of V, if you've seen Starship Troopers or any of that basic genre of television, that's about as much as you need to know going in.
That was kind of what I figured.
Yeah. You know, they're aliens. They've attacked Earth. We got to fight back. We're not doing so good. You know, that's the basic thing. Now, some of the characters that show up at the end of this that are kind of the cavalry or whatever, those are the ones from the 12 issues.
Okay.
But, I mean, they make at best a cameo appearance here. So, do you need to really know any of that stuff? No, not really. I felt this flowed fine out of, you know, having read the other stuff. It was certainly a standalone. I thought it was a really interesting choice to use Barack Obama as the lead character here. I thought it was even more interesting of a twist to have him be mute due to a war injury for most of this issue. I thought they kind of backpedaled on that a little, where they had him actually talk a few times, and it's like, I see why they did that, etc., but I don't know. It was an interesting twist, and then they kind of, you know, hedged on it.
Yeah, I think they did it as a plot device to just remove themselves from too much scrutiny on having him say too many things. I mean, he's just kind of there, and it was his actions, but they didn't have to dialogue the guy that much.
Yeah.
It's just he only speaks essentially in speeches.
That he can write out and have somebody else say, pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because I thought this comic was kind of clearly cashing in on Obama's kind of popularity, his persona, and the almost the mystique around him. And there's pretty much no way this comic would have worked with almost any other politician. And, I mean, I can't imagine this having been done 8 years ago with George Bush, or, you know, even further back with Clinton or half the other presidents we've had. Just because I don't think they've had either the popularity or whatever kind of going in. And I think a lot of how this comic works for a reader is going to depend on what the reader feels about Obama. And, you know, they almost use him like an archetypal superhero story, where it's like, okay, this character's not Superman, but he's essentially Superman. And we've seen tons of stories that use that kind of story shorthand. And here, they needed a character that started out with an air of authority, of charisma, of kind of that hope message or whatever that Obama, you know, really campaigned on. And in that respect, using Obama was almost essential for this story in many respects. And I thought he was well used. I thought the story overall was very good. I enjoyed it. But I'm going to give the story a rating of a 3, whereas I would have given it a 4 and maybe a 5 if they'd been able to tell the same story as effectively with an original character, instead of having to leverage kind of so much on the public persona of Obama. Because as it is, I don't want to say it feels like a cash grab, but it was a story crutch that I'm not totally convinced they needed to use.
I'll agree with you on the 3. I will not agree on the thinking that if they would have stuck an original character in, it would have gone up to a 4 or a 5. I mean, it's a standard vanilla post-apocalyptic sci-fi story. I mean, it's basically a 3-4 story no matter what they do with it.
Well, I didn't say I'd give it a 3 if they just plugged in a generic character. I said if they could tell it as effectively with a generic character. And frankly, yeah, I don't think they could have, which is why I would have given it a higher rating if they had. Because this was so reliant on you going in thinking that the character that Obama is used for is a natural leader, is charismatic, has, you know, that air of authority or what have you. And I really don't think they could have pulled that off if it was a character that was a blank slate from page one. So if they had been able to do that, and I think the deck was stacked against them, to me that would have warranted a four, possibly a five. But you're right. Yeah. Other than that, it is a fairly generic post-apocalyptic sci-fi story.
And they had 48 pages to play with here. So that's a lot of landscape.
Yeah, yeah. They did have plenty of room.
At least, you know, it was 48 pages. I mean, it was $5.99. I mean, I went to the comic shop to buy this thing. I'm like, whoa. You know, with tax, it was like $6.40 or something like that. Like, wow. It's quite a lot.
Yeah, definite sticker shock. I can see that.
And I think at that price, even though it's 48 pages, what it actually did make me think about is, I mean, I was buying it because I had to buy it for the show. I'm relatively certain there's no way I would have paid $6 for this if I wasn't buying it for the show. Some other people might buy it at that price because Barack Obama is on the cover. But it got me to thinking of, like, what is the price point that you're willing to pay for a comic book? And even though price per page, it's cheaper than the Ms. Marvel comic, which is like a standard. I mean, that's not even a high price comic, right? I mean, Ms. Marvel was a $2.99, 22-page book, so 13.6 cents a page. This came out to be 12.5 cents per page. It's just there's something about that $6.
Well, I think it's both the price per page and the total cost. You know, it's yeah. I mean, when I was cutting back due to budget restrictions, this is something I definitely would have passed on, because at $6, I could have gotten, you know, potentially two other comics. So I totally see that. I mean, to me, this is almost the epitome of kind of your standard, you know, direct to sci-fi channel TV movie.
Yeah, exactly. This is something that is like a TV movie with a bunch of actors you never heard of.
Yeah.
Maybe someone who did, you know, movies back in the 70s and hasn't had a job in 15, 20 years. So, yeah.
I mean, it's entertaining, but you're never going to come out of it thinking, wow, this is great art or great, and by that I mean, you know, brilliant story, Shakespeare quality, what have you.
So, do you want to move on to our special feature for episode 100?
Yeah, let's go with that.
Okay. Well, you know, what we were talking about was doing something with this about reviewing comics that were number 100 issues. And we kind of settled pretty quickly upon a Marvel and a DC comic, right? Mm-hmm. But then we were thinking, wow, what indie book could we do? And I put a thread up on the forum with more on this, but I kind of dug around trying to find out what number 100 issues have even happened. So kind of interesting what I found out, and I'll just summarize it really quickly. You know, there were 60 DC comics that were number 100s, but interestingly, 26 of those 60 were non-superhero books. And, you know, war books, Western books, mystery books. There were, like, comedy books, like both The Adventures of Bob Hope and The Adventures of Jerry Lewis both made it to issue 100. And, you know, things like The Fox and the Crow and stuff like that. There were actually two Vertigo books in that number, Hellblazer and 100 Bullets, that ended with number 100. But I found it interesting that, you know, 26 out of 60 DC books were non-superhero books. And then Marvel had 50 books that had made it to 100. Only 12 of those were non-superhero books. Primarily, you know, things like Sergeant Fury and, you know, Kid Colt Outlaw, Two Gun Kid, Conan, you know, things like that. They didn't have, and then, interestingly, Patsy Walker, you know, from the 50s.
Wow.
But, you know, that's pretty much Marvel was mostly superhero books, right? No big surprise. What was then interesting was Archie. You know, like 26 Archie books that made it to 100. And it's like, you know, a lot of people, you know, talk down to Archie. But let's give Archie some credit for selling a heck of a lot of books over the year. There's a lot of Archie books that made it to 100.
I think part of that, though, is they'll stick with those titles forever.
Yeah.
I mean, they'll do a number of spinoffs of Archie, of Betty, Veronica, whatever, but what they don't do is the tons and tons of miniseries, the relaunches, the Archie 2.0, the Archie 3.0, the Archie 15.0, you know, those kinds of reboots and retooling. That's why you've got so many that.
But even their spinoffs go along. I mean, so you have Archie. You have Archie and Friends, Archie and Me, Archie at Riverdale High, Archie Digest, Archie Double Digest, Archie's Joke Book, Archie's Pals and Gals. You know, it's like all these books made it to 100. It's like, wow, that's a lot. You know, you get Betty, Betty and Me, Betty and Veronica, Betty and Veronica Digest, Betty and Veronica Double Digest. All those made it to 100. So, I mean, that's a lot of Archie comics.
Yeah.
Then you kind of, you know, so I mean, I thought that was a really credible standing compared to Marvel and DC that, you know, 60 for DC, 50 for Marvel, and then 26 for Archie. I mean, they had half as many books make it to 100 as Marvel did. Mm. Then you drop off by half again. Harvey has 13 books that made it up there. You know, Harvey, it's, you know, you got your standard stuff. There's like four different Richie Rich books. You got a couple of Sad Sacks, Hot Stuff, Casper, you know, Sad Sack, you know, things like this. You know, everyone's heard of these books. You probably read them when you were a kid. Dell had 10, mostly things like Four Color Comics, Lone Ranger, Tarzan, Woody Woodpecker, Gene Autry, Red Ryder, Roy Rogers, lots of Western books and that kind of stuff. Charlton had 8. Interesting ones that they had, you know, they had Fighting Army, Fighting Marines, Fighting Navy. They had a niche there and they were keeping with it. Ghostly Tales, Popeye, Beetle Bailey, things like that. Then I counted 6 Disney books that had made it to 100. I mean, I just counted those as Disney and not like whatever licensee was, you know, doing them. But,
that,
you know,
that makes sense.
Donald, Mickey Mouse, Uncle Scrooge, Walt Disney's comics and stories, you know, that kind of stuff. Then it kind of dropped off. You know, Dark Horse had 4. 2 of those were mangas. Usagi Yojimbo, which we've talked about. One of the few contemporary independent books to make it to 100. Then you had Fawcett had 4, you know, variations of Captain Marvel. ACG had 3. Image had 3. Savage Dragon, Spawn, and Witchblade. Lev Gleason had 3. Warren had 3. All the magazines, Creepy, Eerie, and Vampirella. And then it's just a bunch of ones that, you know, just like 1 or 2. But of note in there was the fact that Cerebus the Aardvark, you know, famous indie book that made it. Knights of the Dinner Table that we've talked about before. Nexus. You know, these are ones, and then Simpsons comics, and we just talked about the Radioactive Man crossover a little while ago. So, you know, those have all made it to 100, and it's like a very rarefied group of books that have actually made it to 100. So I just found it very interesting to go in and kind of dig around at that.
One of the ones I want to point out that I find really interesting is from Claypool, and that's Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. Now, that went to 100 issues. And Claypool published for like 10 years and was, I think, one of the lowest profile publishers out there. They had a title done by Peter David for, I'm going to say, 80 some odd issues that I think most people have probably almost never heard of. And that was Soul Searchers.
Soul Searchers, yeah. Yep.
I think the Claypool one really goes to show how even if you're selling a low number of copies, because I think the only Claypool title I ever saw on the top 300 list was Elvira, and that was down under 1,000 units for each issue. But they were able to make that go for forever, you know?
Yeah.
So it just comes down to, you know, what's their expectations and you know, how are the sales working for them?
So it was a very interesting exercise, you know, and it's like, you get a chance, go out to the forum, look for the thread that I called, let's see here, Comics Ahead in issue number 100, and just kind of take a look at it because it's kind of interesting reading. And if you see one that I missed on there, you can comment on the forum. But, you know, it's just very interesting for me to go through and see which books had made it. So anyway, we're going to review now a couple of books from years past. Do you want to do DC first or Marvel first?
I was thinking DC.
Okay. Stick with our basic format and go DC first. So one of the famous books that DC had, of course, is Justice League of America. And the interesting thing about Justice League that I always liked about the old Justice League books was they had these crossovers every year or so, or, you know, sometimes even more than every year, just because they were very popular stories. And number 100 started off with a three-issue crossover, actually, where it teamed up the Justice League, the Justice Society, and they were on a quest to recover the lost Seven Soldiers of Victory. Who, of course, the Seven Soldiers are Green Arrow, Speedy, Vigilante, Shining Knight, Crimson Avenger, and Star-Spangled Kid and Stripesy. And then Crimson Avenger's sidekick Wing always got the shaft in the Seven Soldiers because he was the eighth guy, but he never got counted in the alliterative Seven Soldiers. Right? Because they counted Speedy, who was Green Lantern's sidekick. They counted Stripesy, who is Star-Spangled Kid's sidekick. But Wing, who is Crimson Avenger's sidekick, he got the shaft. You know, it's like, you lose, Wing. You don't even get counted. As I was reading this, and I read 100, 101, and 102 to get the whole crossover in, what my initial thought, I mean, I remember loving this. This particular crossover, I remember reading when I was a kid, and I picked it up. I must have picked it up at the newsstand because there are several scenes in here that I vividly remember and were just really cool to me and got me into the comics. And in fact, seeing a book like this that has just, you know, it's touted on the cover of number 100 here, 33 Heroes, the greatest gathering of superstars ever recorded. You know, the 10th annual team up of the Justice League and Justice Society in search of the Seven Soldiers of Victory. And you see, it's like 33 heroes in, you know, 20, 22 pages or whatever for 20 cents. I mean, you can't get a deal like that when you're a kid. I just ate it up and I saw all these heroes and everything. And the thing that I found interesting on rereading it is DC Comics in particular from this time period, you can't think about them too hard. You know?
Yeah.
You just kind of go with it. You enjoy the story. But if I put the same kind of analysis onto this story that I kind of do onto like a modern story, because the way people write stories today is a little more well thought out and, you know, a little more tight. I mean, I just like find myself, I started digressing into that. And it's like, man, that's weak, you know? And it's like, oh, you know, this is just a fun story. Just, you know, don't think too hard about it. It'll drive you nuts. And that's just the mindset you have to have in reading these older DC books. It's just, they were written as, you know, good fun. They were written to, you know, get the kids excited about the comics, and they worked because, I mean, I love this thing. I mean, there's this one scene in, it's actually in number 102 where they're kind of talking about who's going to go and, you know, save the universe with this nebula rod or whatever the heck it is. And, you know, Green Lantern's talking about, I'll go, my power ring will protect me. And then the Alan Scott Green Lantern says, well, so would mine. Why shouldn't I go? And then Green Arrow jumps in and says, but neither of your rings would protect you from this. A yellow wooden arrow, a combination of both your weaknesses. And I thought that was cool when I was a kid. You know, it's like Green Arrow just whips out this yellow wooden arrow. You know, it's like twang, you know. Takes both of them out with.
And to think he's Green Arrow's best friend. I mean, what kind of a friend is that? I mean, come on. No.
That's like Batman always had those plans on how to take people down. So it was years later. Maybe that had its genesis with that writer reading a book like this when he was young. You know, Grant Morrison, I don't know. But, you know, I enjoyed it. I haven't read this in many years. And just going through it, you know, overlooking some of the overtly silly aspects of the story and some of the logic that doesn't quite hold up. It followed the classic pattern.
Oh, yeah.
You know, where you huge ton of heroes, you break them up into smaller groups so you can get a little bit more characterization on it. There were so darn many heroes here. They broke them up into, what, like seven groups or something like that?
Yeah.
You know, so it's just like, you know, lots of story to tell here. But I really enjoyed diving back into it.
I'm a huge, huge fan of the classic JLA-JSA crossovers. For the longest time, my run or my collection of JLA jumped, you know, to two or three issues every year interval or whatever, to where I had essentially just those until I filled in a lot of the gaps. There's still a lot of the ones kind of prior to this that I don't have all of. I'll be honest, I was too lazy to go dig out this issue out of my drawer boxes, so I was reading it in the Crisis on Multiple Earths Volume 3 trade paperback. And anyone who likes JLA-JSA crossovers, I mean, go pick up this series of trades. I mean, these are just some great stories. But I mean, you're right, Bob. You've got to take these stories for what they are and for when they were written. And I don't mean that in a way of, oh, you've got to make excuses, whatever. You've just got to realize that the storytelling style back then was fundamentally different. Things that took, you know, an issue then would take, you know, a 12-issue miniseries and, you know, five spinoffs to go do today. And I think a good example of that is when you go towards the end of this storyline where they're trying to, you know, get the Nebula Rod stuff ready to go take out the bad guy. And we get this series of, you know, almost like a slideshow kind of a thing as they assemble the weapon. You know, and it goes from, yeah, it'd take a lot of time to put that together, and half a page later, hey, we're done. And you're right, this is also a classic storytelling style they use in the JLA-JSA team-ups of gather both teams and then split them up into groups of two or three people. But when you've got, like, 32, 33 characters between the JLA, the JSA, and the Seven Soldiers, much less anyone else they encounter, you kind of have to do that. Now, one part of this I probably did think a little too much about was as I was reading the first part of the story, a lot of it was them kind of getting told by the Oracle, and this is not the Barbara Gordon one, but a you know, mystical cosmic one summoned by Dr. Fate, Zatanna, and Johnny Thunder's Thunderbolt. You know, most of that first issue is the Oracle telling them, you know, what happened with the Nebula Man, what happened with the Seven Soldiers, all that kind of stuff. And there were a couple of times where, you know, the Oracle's, oh, you misunderstood me. What I meant to say or what I mean was type thing.
They were arguing with that Oracle a lot. You know, it's like, you bring this guy down and, you know.
For such a smart guy, maybe if he spoke a little clearer, he wouldn't get misunderstood so often. You know, couldn't he just say, no, they're trapped in the past. They're not dead. You know, things like that.
He had a mystic cosmic entity. They can't, they have to talk in very circular fashion. But then again, he doesn't just leave it at that. When they don't understand what the heck he's talking about, he then clarifies it. So I guess you kind of get both sides of that one.
Hey, he's got a little bit of a chip on his shoulder, but I will give him credit for being patient and eventually explaining himself. But, I mean, overall, this is the kind of stuff that I loved as a kid. I picked this up and read it originally when it was in one of the, like, the Blue Ridge Digests or one of those things way back. So I read this, obviously not when it first came out, but... you know, when I was a kid, and it was great stuff.
I have vivid memories of this series, this set of three issues, though, and I actually picked these out to bring with me when I saw Len Wein at a convention a couple of years ago, and he autographed all three of these for me. But this is, you know, Len Wein wrote this, and, you know, it's just classic early 70s stuff. This was like
72,
right? This is actually right around the same time as Spider-Man 100.
Yeah, it's about a year later, because Spider-Man 100 was September 71.
Yeah.
Now, for my money, the peak of the quality for the JLA-JSA team-ups was probably about 10 years later, whenever, when you had the JLA-JSA going up against the Secret Society of Supervillains. You had the JLA-JSA All-Star Squadron going up against the Crime Syndicate. They had a couple that were near the late 100s, early 200s of the JLA series that, for me, I mean, man, those things, I loved those.
I think those would hold up a little better by today's standards. I mean, you were getting a little more into those are like, you're in the 80s there.
Yeah.
You know, they were a little more of the modern style of storytelling.
More the modern style of storytelling. George Perez on the art for quite a few of them, or Jerry Ordway, or some other real classic artists. And there's nothing wrong with the art here, but, you know, it's for me, you know, you can't go wrong with a George Perez story.
But I guess what I'll end this, I mean, I'll second your recommendation, though. Anyone who has not read these old Justice League, JSA crossovers, go seek out the trade paperbacks called Crisis on Multiple Earths. There's a number of them, and they reprint these crossovers. And this is in Volume 3. And just seek them out, because this is classic, classic stuff.
Yeah. Now, one thing I do want to say about this is, depending if you count that first page or not, which was kind of a, not part of the story, but not a recap page. It was almost like a interior cover, if you will. So it's either 23 or 24 story pages, depending how you count it. It was a 20-cent cover price, so we're talking 9/10 of a cent per page, you know, which is a tiny, tiny fraction of that 13.6 cents per story page we're paying now for most things. You know, a couple of decades of inflation, price rising, you know, better printing quality paper, et cetera, et cetera. It catches up.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is just they're paying the talent the living wage, too. I don't think these guys made a whole lot of money.
No, probably not.
Putting these things out. You know, but just... You know, kind of looking at it from the standpoint of, you know, how much money that you could make as a kid. You know, I could make, it was not a problem if I applied myself to, you know, like washing cars, mowing lawns, doing chores and stuff like that. I could make $1 to $2 a week. And, you know, $1 to $2 a week in 1971, 1972, when comics are, you know, 20 cents here, you know, I could buy 8 to 10 comic books a week, you know.
Well, and that was today, most of what they were putting, you know, out back then, too.
Right. But now you got, like, books that are $3 and $4 a pop. You know, to buy a similar number of books, you know, a kid would need to be making $30+ a week. And I think it'll be a little more challenging for someone to make that kind of money doing odd jobs.
Yeah, a kid today needs to be a day trader on the stock market, I think, to pay for comics. And a good one at that.
Well, which is what really has, you know, skewed the demographic on these things. But, you know, it's how it is. So let's go over to Marvel. We're going to go back in time one more year to 1971, and we're going to look at The Amazing Spider-Man number 100. This is another book that I read off the rack when it came out. This book would have had a lot less impact to me personally if I had had an internet to know. I would have been spoiled as to what happened on the last page. You know, it just, you know, wouldn't have been the same. I just remember getting blown away when I got to the last page of this issue. I thought it was a very nicely done story, though. Holds up better against today's storytelling, I think, than the Justice League stuff did. What I liked about it, you know, you got Gil Kane art, and Stan Lee, of course, wrote this. And the premise here is that Peter's in love with Gwen Stacy. Doesn't know, you know, it's still 30 years before he is to find out that she's playing around with Norman Osborn, his greatest enemy on him. Let's forget that that ever happened. She's just his faithful girlfriend who he loves. And he decides, okay, Spider-Man interferes with my life. I'm going to take this serum that I've been creating, and I'm going to give myself this serum that's going to make me normal again. And, you know, I've been working on this because I never knew if my radioactive blood would become dangerous and I'd have to cure myself of being Spider-Man. So, takes this potion and then feeling a little woozy and he falls asleep. And this is just I liked this technique that Stan used because, you know, he's got him going to sleep and that gives you a nice excuse for the dream sequence, which is essentially kind of a flashback. You get a flashback for a page of his origin. You've got a bunch of page or two vignettes where he's fighting a lot of his classic bad guys. He's going up against the Vulture. We got the Lizard, the Green Goblin, Doc Ock, the Kingpin. You know, it's just, you know, this is great. I mean, he has a conversation with the ghost of Captain Stacy. And, you know, Stan kind of foreshadows a lot of what's going on. And this is like a 40-year-old book, you know, 30-year-old book, so I'm going to spoil it. You know, his sides are hurting him. And then on the last page, you turn in, like, boom, he, like, grows these extra four arms. And it's like he's actually much more spider-like. It's kind of like a similar thing that they did with the Beast when he was trying to cure himself of his mutation. And instead of becoming less bestial, he became more bestial by getting the blue fur and everything, which was originally gray fur, but that's another story. But, you know, here, boom, Spider-Man, extra arms. And what I like about this is at the bottom of that last page, it says, important note, there'll be no cop-out, we promise you. Spidey is really awake, he has six arms, and our tale will be continued next issue. And I got to tell you, there was probably at no point in my life that I want to get the next issue more than when I flipped the page and read the last issue of this comic book when it came out. So this one was, you know, the bee's knees to me when I was a young lad of about 9 years old when I read this the first time. What do you think about it, reading it a little later on? How did it hold up?
I had mixed feelings about it. First off, I was reading this out of the Amazing Spider-Man DVD-ROM collection. So I was reading it on the computer and not, you know, flipping the pages and stuff. That I didn't think was a huge, huge deal or whatever. Definitely this is the start of a classic story. But to me, it's just that, the start of the classic storyline. And I see this last panel where he's got these extra arms is really kind of, okay, from there forward is the stuff I'm really interested in. And the part of it, there were two things about this that didn't totally work for him. One, given Peter Parker's sense of guilt, which, let's face it, is a defining characteristic. Oh, if I'd only saved Uncle Ben before, you know, stopped the murderer before he killed Uncle Ben, all that kind of stuff. The whole thing here of, oh, if I could have saved, you know, Captain Stacy, all that kind of stuff. And guilt defines Spider-Man and Peter Parker. I am surprised he would take a potion to cure himself. And one, it just seems like a bad idea to witness what happened. But two, suppose that it actually worked. He's just setting himself up for a lifetime. If only I still had my powers, I could do something kind of guilt. So that whole thing seemed a little kind of short-sighted, not well thought out. I did like they at least the radioactive blood could be dangerous. That's why I was developing something to cure me. That, okay, that makes sense. The other part that worked much better for you, apparently, than it did for me was the dream sequence. It went on for like 11 of the 19 pages, and it just felt a little excessive. It wasn't bad or anything, but I was waiting for them to get back to the story, if you will.
Yeah, see, I love the dream sequence because that's the kind of thing that it gave you, because it's an anniversary issue, right? You look at the Justice League one, the story is you got these 33 heroes crammed in there, right? And that's what made it like this special thing. And here, I've got an issue 100, and I get to see a whole bunch of Spider-Man bad guys, and he's fighting all these different bad guys, and all under one cover.
That's fair. I see the appeal of that. Certainly with Justice League of America 200, they did a lot of things that harkened back to their origin. They had a lot of the classic earlier members and the members they had at issue 200 and stuff. So it was original JLA versus the new, that kind of a thing. So I get the using the dream sequence as a flashback to let you toss in a lot more villains and stuff than you really otherwise could. And in that respect, that did work. The other thing I think really worked was I like this art style of Gil Kane's much better than his kind of blockier style that he developed a decade or two later. This is more along the lines of, you know, kind of, I don't want to say the Marvel House style, but you know what I mean. You look at his later work and it, you know, on, you know, Sword of the Atom and things, you know, around the late 80s or whatever. And, you know, I just like this style a lot better.
Yeah. Well, you do have your classic, you know, view up the person's nose shot that Gil Kane is famous for. He does those all the time. You get a couple of those.
Oh, yeah.
In here.
Yeah. But it was a cleaner, tighter art style than a lot of his later work, which I'm a bit more.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I liked it. I didn't love it. And, you know, again, to me, it ended on a really high note, and I could definitely see, oh, wow, I can't wait till the next issue. Certainly if you were getting it as it came out. I totally get that.
See, and that's what they were going for back then. That was really the thing. I mean, they're selling this as a periodical, and Stan was a master of, you know, because I remember that even from the first Spider-Man issue that I read. I mean, he'd leave it off with you know, some kind of a thing that just has you craving to come back and buy that next issue. And that was his job, right?
Yeah, well, it's the what will happen next aspect of it. And,
right.
And that's missing from a lot of comics these days.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, well, kind of to your point, you know, it's like with the Ms. Marvel that we're talking about, you know, you've got something going on there where it's like, you know, they're jumping around so much in the different story arcs that you're kind of like, you know, what it seems clear that you wouldn't be anywhere near as confused by any of that if you were just buying the trade paperbacks, and each trade paperback is, you know, some distinct, coherent slice of a story. But, you know, as you're reading the issue month in and month out, it just does seem like it's jumping all over the place.
Yeah.
You know, whereas this, you know, you got different story arcs happen, but they all kind of hang together with kind of an overall narrative. So I think that is done relatively effective with this. So I do think that, you know, especially back then, you wanted to leave the reader with a sense of, man, I've got to come back and buy Spider-Man again next month. And
I think they should be doing that today, though.
Yeah, well, I know, but I mean, Stan could do that, and he could do it damn well, because, you know, I had read, you know, your spotty issues of, you know, Hot Stuff and Richie Rich and, you know, whatever else are on that list of 100 books. You know, I've probably read a lot of those, you know, some, you know, Little Archie here, or, you know, this or that. What really got me started reading and collecting comics was Stan's Amazing Spider-Man.
Yeah.
I mean, he could tell a story. But at least to a 9 or 10 year old kid, man, I could not wait to come back and buy the next one. I couldn't give him my two dimes again fast enough.
Well, and that's a sign of a successful writer. Is not only did you enjoy that one, you couldn't wait to buy the next. Personally, I give both of these issue 100s a 3. I think they were both really good for what they were. You know, I liked aspects of the Justice League a little bit more than the Spider-Man, and vice versa. Both are well worth checking out. And anyone who's interested in the older Marvel stuff, if you can find the DVD-ROM collections, which are out of print or whatever, I highly recommend those. Because they're not that expensive, and you get like 500 copies, or 500 issues on the DVD-ROM.
Which is much more effective prior to the 90s, when they started crossing things over into everything else. Because I don't think they have the issues of Spectacular and
no
Web of and other things that you're only getting, you know, spotty coverage on a lot of these crossovers that would wind through all the different Spider-Man books. So
yeah, and that's a big problem on the X-Men collection and stuff like that, but for the Ghost Rider one, the Hulk one, the Captain America one, it's less of an issue.
So I gave obviously Justice League, I gave that a 4. And I kind of like look back on it, and I'm trying to give my rating not from today, but from the effect it had on me when I read it the first time. And I'd say the Justice League story was a solid 4. The Spider-Man, on the other hand, was a 5 for me. I mean, there was nothing better than this Spider-Man issue when I was a kid. And even now, looking at it, But, I mean, I'm biased because I have that lens that I'm looking at it through. But
well, if I were to go that way with the JLA, I'd almost have to go with a 5 for any JLA-JSA crossover. Because, I mean, that's a lot of what got me hooked on those characters and stuff.
Yeah, so. But, you know, as it stands, I mean, the Spider-Man one, for me, holds up a little better than the Justice League one by today's standards. Again, that's just for me. I found myself cringing at a lot more stuff in the Justice League book than the Spider-Man story. There we have it. That was episode 100. We have done 100 weeks in a row at this point. We have not missed a week.
Only once have we been a day late, and that was because I was in Japan. So it was 99 Mondays and one.
So it's interesting, too, because, you know, this one, we always have it go up on Monday, but, you know, this one's going to be our second annual San Diego type of episode going on here, where we're recording this just prior to you leaving to drive out to San Diego. We'll record the next episode while you're here at my house prior to the con. And then the next episode we'll have to scramble to get up when you're back from con.
Yeah.
So, got a little bit of a perturbation there because of the convention. So.
Now, like you said, 100 episodes. I've actually done a little math this evening. By my count, not including all the things we covered with the Messiah Complex and the Sinestro Corps War, which in our show notes we only had listed as Sinestro Corps War and Messiah Complex, we've reviewed 379 comics. 113 of those were DC, 110 were Marvel, 156 were Other. We've done, I believe, 283 different titles over the course of those 79 issues. So we've, I think, covered quite a bit, both Marvel, DC, and independent stuff.
And we're, you know, not daily, but we frequently get feedback from people who are listeners of the show that tell us that they started picking up a book because we talked about it. And that's the best feeling for me, because that's kind of the reason why we're doing this, other than we just like to hear ourselves talk, I think. But, you know, I like being able to turn people on to something they might not have otherwise tried in comics.
Well, I mean, that's part of what I really enjoy about this, is not only have we turned people on to books, but they've turned us on to a couple.
Yep.
You know, I know that I would not have gotten Rogue Angel, Teller of Tales, if you hadn't recommended it. Same with Foundation. Toopy Doops is one that one of our listeners recommended. Loved that.
Yeah.
Hopefully there'll be another issue available when we're at San Diego. And they'll have like a seventh issue out, hopefully, or something, because I'd love to read more of that. You know, so there have been quite a few things that I simply wouldn't have read if people hadn't have been pointing them out.
With that, I think we can draw this one to a close. Our next episode will be a live episode, sort of. And we'll both be on Skype, but we'll be sitting in the same room. And we will talk to everyone next week.
Ooh, the only other thing left to do, though, is the code phrase, the magic code phrase for San Diego.
That's right.
So, what should we use for the secret phrase for the free comics at Comic-Con?
Okay, how about this? Just come up to either myself or John, because we're going to have some other people, probably my son and my nieces, handing out comics at the door, and they'll be handing out individual comics. So if you want the extra size set of more than one comic, find me or John, and just say to us, "Hey, I listen to the Comic Book Page podcast," and that's good enough for us. If you're one of our listeners, you'll get the extra comics.
Exactly. Because we want to reward people for listening, we'd also like to encourage you to join our forum and to participate in the community. Because, again, we're doing this for you guys as much as anything else. Have fun at San Diego. We will see you at the podcasting panel. That's where we'll have the majority of the books. We may have some on us while we're on the floor. We may not. It depends. I like to travel light because I'm old, fat, and lazy. And just way out of shape.
Oh, and by the way, just a reminder, podcasting panel, Thursday, 5:30 to 6:30 in room 32AB.
And then after that, we're going to be doing dinner. I believe the plan right now is the
Rock Bottom Brewery. And I called them, and they can do gluten-free food for you.
Awesome. Not getting poisoned at con, high on my list of things to do. We'll see you at Comic-Con.
Thanks for joining us for our 100th episode. Join us next week when we discuss Blackest Night number 1 from DC, Mighty Avengers number 27 from Marvel, and Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep from Boom Studios.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.
everyone. This is Matt Kramer from the Legion of Substitute Podcasters, and I wanted to bring to everyone's attention a special episode of our show spotlighting the excellent book Rebels. In episode 41 of Legion of Substitute Podcasters, we sit down for an hour-long chat with Rebels scribe Tony Bedard and cover topics such as his experience as a letterer and an editor, his work with excellent artists like Andy Clark, Claude Saint-Aubin, and Paul Pelletier. We get some teasers to future storylines in Rebels, and many more topics, including Tony's nickname in college. You can listen to this interview on Legion of Substitute Podcasters, episode 41, which will be released on Monday, July 20th. You can find this episode at www.legionofsubstitutepodcasters.com or search iTunes for Legion of Substitute Podcasters. While you're listening to this episode, why not stick around for more? We've heard that people have a tough time understanding the Legion of Superheroes. It's hard to keep track of which lad, lass, boy, or girl is which. Paul French, Darren Noel, and myself, Matt Kramer, make understanding the Legion as easy as possible. In our retro review segments, we take a chronological look at the Legion, starting with Adventure Comics 247, and have taken breaks in our retro reviews to visit the classic 80s Baxter Legion in An Eye for an Eye, and the current Geoff Johns take on the Legion, including Final Crisis Legion of Three Worlds. So hop into the time bubble with us every Monday. We'll see you in the future.